You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Hey y'all, this is Mark. Welcome to episode 168. Today's episode is all about a new exhibit at the Historic New Orleans Collection. The exhibit is titled Spanish New Orleans in the Caribbean and highlights Spain's impact on Louisiana. The last show was all about the town of Abita Springs and its Fall Fest. If you missed it, go back and give it a listen. I think you'll enjoy it. Before we jump in, let me talk about the people that make this show possible. While I happen to be at the Historic New Orleans Collection today, they're also a supporter of the podcast. They're the city's premier history museum located at 520 Royal Street in the heart of the French Quarter. Today, as you're going to hear about the exhibit, we're going to give you yet one more reason to come and experience all that the Historic New Orleans Collection has to offer. But check out their online publication called First Draft. It's a combination blog and online exhibition space, and you can find it at hnoc.org/firstdraft. Starting on October 20th, really on the 19th, there's a concert that we're going to talk about in a bit. But starting on October 20th and running through January 22nd of 2023, the Historic New Orleans Collection will present an exhibit entitled Spanish New Orleans in the Caribbean. While we call the original city the French Quarter, there's an amazing amount of Spanish influence here. The exhibit includes more than 125 pieces from the Historic New Orleans Collection's own collections, as well as from other museums in the United States and Spain. In fact, the exhibit is the subject, again, of today's episode, so you're going to hear a lot more about it. One last thing I want to mention is they have an upcoming exhibit about the architecture and the building and the rebuilding of Notre Dame in Paris. It is hard to explain. We're going to do more about it as it gets closer, but it's a 3D sort of immersive exhibit that just looks amazing. It's traveling. If you happen to live in the Washington, D.C. area right now or recently, it was at the Building Museum. I'm really excited to see it and really excited to tell you more about it when it comes. In any event, go over to hnoc.org/visit to plan your trip. The most frequent questions I get asked are about moving to New Orleans, and if you're ready to make the move, you need a good realtor. That's where Liz Wood comes in. Let Liz and her team over at Liz Wood Realty help you find the right place. They can help whether you plan to rent or purchase. Liz makes the process fun and easy, so reach out to Liz at lizwoodrealty.com and make your dream of living in New Orleans a reality. And while you're working with Liz, you're going to need her secure financing. Reach out to Tommy Manzella at Gulf Coast and let him help you get everything in place. That's what we did when we refied last year, and it was as smooth as could be. There'll be links in the show notes to everything that we've discussed, as well as our partners, but it's Tommy Manzella at Gulf Coast Bank. And finally, before we jump in, I have a book, The Beyond Bourbon Street Insider's Guide to New Orleans, officially released on May 1st. You can find it online at major retailers like Amazon, Bookshop, Barnes & Noble, and more. In New Orleans, you can find it at lots of places. Octavia Books, Blue Cypress has it, Frenchman Street Bookshop, The OW, which is a store located at 2850 Magazine Street, Flirty Girl in the French Quarter, and NOLA T-Shirt Club on Magazine Street. NOLA T-Shirt Club, if you go to their website, nolatshirtclub.com, they also have copies online that are autographed by me. If you love the show, the podcast, and New Orleans, please consider picking up a copy. And for more on the book, check out episode 157. Okay, enough about all of that. I am joined today by Mr. Alfred Lemon, the director of the Williams Research Center at the Historic New Orleans Collection. Welcome to the show. How are you?
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
You may have a hard time limiting my words because you mentioned three things that are favorites of mine. First of all, the impact of Spain on Louisiana. Mm-hmm. Second of all, music. And third of all, Notre Dame Cathedral. So you may have a hard time controlling the number of words I use today.
Well, let's see. Before we get into a couple of those, I want to tell, I think the Historic New Orleans Collection, particularly for locals, people walk by it, and it's expanded over time. So there's a lot of stuff here. But you're the director of the Research Center. Let's talk just a little bit for a moment about what the Research Center is and what it does, and what do you offer here?
The Research Center is comprised of three buildings. The main building was completed in 1917 and was originally a courthouse and a jail.
I did not know that.
And of probably all the buildings that we have, because of the sheer size of the facade, you know, it's the hardest for people to walk by and not notice it.
Mm-hmm.
The 533 building, which is so important to the city historically, blends in with the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
The 520 building blends in less with the landscape, but this one is sort of like a neon sign because it's so much bigger than everything else surrounding.
Sure.
But our holdings really document the ongoing, continuing profile, developing profile of New Orleans. One of the things that we have that is an absolute treasure, it's a project that has been going on for over 60 years, and that is documenting the history of the French Quarter,
mm-hmm.
from the earliest settlers through the present day. And we're very proud to say, we have an online version and we have the original version,
yeah.
which of course is paper-based.
Sure.
And you can get to the online version very easily. Even I can do it. And you just simply go to our website, click on research, and then you look under online resources, and you'll see the Colin C. DeBall Vieux Carré survey. It's really a remarkable tool that can open up so many aspects of New Orleans history. It can open up the general development of the French Quarter. Mm-hmm. It can open up social history. It can open up architectural history. It's sort of a wonderful place to begin if you're working on the French Quarter.
Yeah, it really is. So one of the things I would say as a researcher through the podcast and the book is that I come here frequently when I'm doing research because the individuals that work here are so knowledgeable and can point you towards so many artifacts. But you have so much online, and then it blends with the Tricentennial Center that opened a couple years ago.
Right.
And that kind of immersive experience of walking through 300 years of the French Quarter. But as you mentioned, we want you to come to the Historic New Orleans collection and see all there is to offer. But you can go online now and really kind of step
right.
through.
And there is nothing that can replace our staff
mm-hmm.
because our staff is just so knowledgeable. I often think of the comment that the director of the Huntington Library made. And he was asked, what would you rescue first if the Huntington, which is such a great mm-hmm. library, would go up in flames? And he said, I'd rescue the staff first because their knowledge is so great. You know, not only do they know how to find a book, find a map, find a manuscript, find a drawing, but they've had the experience mm-hmm. of living with them on a day-to-day basis. And that's why when a researcher comes, we like to take the time to simply have a conversation with them. Because in the course of that conversation, the researcher might say something that will make the staff member say, oh,
Yes.
You think you need this, but you really need this.
Yes.
And
I've had that
really
experience.
Pride ourselves in a personal experience, you know, because who wants to deal with an unfriendly librarian?
Well,
you know, we're supposed to be welcoming and not scare the people away.
And
that's what we try to do.
Well, my experience has been that the researchers and the librarians that work here are so excited when someone walks in and they can share their knowledge.
Exactly.
I have walked in several times with just a theme of an idea and said, this is kind of what I'm thinking about for a podcast episode. And they have really helped me either dive into that or kind of taken me on a tangent and said, well, why don't you shift it a little bit and look at this? And we have all this collection. I don't know that I've ever talked about it on the show, but they're coming to the research center here, as well as I'll give a shout out to the folks on the third floor of the New Orleans Public Library, the main library.
Yes.
Those two groups of people are phenomenal for almost anything you want to research about New Orleans or Louisiana in
exactly.
general.
Exactly. You know, and we've cooperated with them on a variety of projects. One of them is the New Orleans obituary file, which is now online. The New Orleans Public Library has two things that date from the WPA. One is the History and News Index, and one is the obituary file. And of course, you know, now a great deal is digitized.
Sure.
But that, especially the obituary index, we were very proud to work with them on that. Because, first of all, there was no security copy.
Mm.
And second of all, it just opened that resource up to so many people.
Yeah, and that's kind of a good summary of, that's why I want people to know, not only about the topics we're going to talk about today, but about the fact that the Research Center exists, and that there's so much here, and that the librarians here are knowledgeable, they're friendly, they want to help. I've pointed people here who are interested in sort of family history.
Right.
You know, somebody that says, my great-great-great-grandmother grew up in the French Quarter, for instance, right?
Right.
Perfect, right up the alley to be able to come in here and often find information and also now kind of get a sense of what the French Quarter might have looked like 200 years ago when your ancestor
exactly.
was here. So besides the hopefully selling you on why you ought to come to see the exhibits, the Research Center is this hidden gem here that I think, obviously, researchers like myself, I think about people like Richard Campanella, authors, are well-versed in what you guys offer. But
right.
I think the general public doesn't know that.
One of the things to keep in mind is, you know, 40, 50 years ago, the French Quarter was a residential neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And that atmosphere has been lost. So there's a lot of people now that live in the suburbs that the French Quarter is really still their home. And so we just have so much information, like if they want to know what their house looked like,
mm-hmm.
you know, we have not only the Vieux Carré survey, but other resources are as well.
Sure.
And our whole purpose is to serve the public.
Yep.
And that's why we're here.
And that's
so
why I bring it up.
Of us.
Yes, absolutely. So I want to get into the exhibition, but before we do, I want to talk a little bit, maybe set the stage. You know, the exhibit is obviously about the Spanish and the Caribbean influence in New Orleans, and we'll certainly talk about that period of time. But I want to kind of jump back earlier because the Spaniards came to North America and really were invested in North America maybe much earlier. People think about Jamestown and Plymouth, but the Spanish were here, you know, settled St. Augustine much earlier.
Augustine, yes. You know, you're absolutely right. People often forget that St. Augustine, and I think Santa Fe, are the oldest cities in the United States. And, you know, it's very interesting. We think about Hernando de Soto. He came here. He explored the region. You know, he died here.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at the time he was doing that, they were finding tremendous sources of wealth in Mexico and in Peru, and they didn't find that here. So they focused their attention on Mexico and Peru. And then finally, of course, La Salle came down the Mississippi River and claimed Louisiana. But even there, the French didn't hurry to do anything because before investing money, they wanted that claim to be ratified, which was eventually done at the Treaty of Ryswick. Okay, so then, right at the moment where France is beginning to invest in Louisiana, things begin to happen in Europe that would change everything tremendously. First of all, the King of Spain died. The King of Spain was a Habsburg, and he was the last of the Habsburg kings of Spain and had no heir. Well, the French and the Spanish, if you go back to the 9th or 10th century, perhaps every generation of French and Spanish royalty, there was some sort of intermarriage.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Louis XIV was married to a Spanish infanta or princess. And so the question was, to whom would fall Spain? Well, Louis XIV's wife, when she married him, she had to give up her right to the Spanish throne.
Mm-hmm.
The first person in line for the French throne had to give up his right to the Spanish throne. The second person in line had to give up his right to the Spanish throne. But the French thought, if they got through the first person and the second person, that the third person, you know, they would be safe. So it fell to the Duc d'Anjou, a grandson of Louis XIV, to become King of Spain. Well, you can imagine what the other powers thought in Europe. They were not happy campers.
Sure.
You know, the Austrians, the Hungarians, the Germanic states, the British, none of them liked that, because just imagine what a powerhouse would be created by the unification of France and Spain, by having a Bourbon monarch
mm-hmm.
on the French throne and a Bourbon monarch on the Spanish throne. So after a very lengthy war, and when I say lengthy, it wasn't a 5 or 6 year war, it was more like 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Duc d'Anjou was officially King of Spain. So then you see, after that war is settled, France beginning to invest more time, effort, and money into Louisiana. But you have to stop and think. The closest French colonies, one was New France, where you had Quebec and Montreal, where the river was frozen most of the mm-hmm. time, that made communications very difficult. So that left Saint-Domingue.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Saint-Domingue, of course, was in the Caribbean. And guess what you had running all over the Caribbean? Was pirates and all sorts of people ready to snap up the contents of your boats. So, who did the early founders of Louisiana depend upon? Bienville, for example. He depended upon Havana. He was bringing animals from Havana. He was getting weapons from Havana. He was getting food from Havana. Havana was a shipbuilding center. He was getting ships from Havana. Same thing with Veracruz. You know, and people don't realize that we had that incredibly close relation to those Spanish colonies in the very beginnings of the French period. In fact, so much so that Bienville sent a delegation of people from Louisiana to Mexico specifically to thank the viceroy for the assistance that he gave the young colony of French Louisiana.
Hmm.
Now, they didn't always perfectly get along.
Right, sure.
But they did rely upon each other, even to the extent, now this may really confuse some people, that in 1741, it was decided by the Christian Brothers, you know, they have De La Salle High School right. in St. Charles, that they should build in New Orleans a school for Spanish boys from Veracruz. Now, this is unbelievable. Why would they want to build a Spanish school in New Orleans for young boys from Veracruz? I don't know how many of you have ever driven from Veracruz to Mexico City. But it is an experience. You have to go through swamps. You have to go through mountains. It's a real journey. And quite simply, for those young boys, it was easier for them to get to New Orleans than to Mexico City. Imagine that. The school was never a reality, but it was proposed.
Hmm.
It's an indication of the closeness between the two colonies.
Sure.
And I like to think of us not so much as a French or a Spanish colony, but sometimes I think we were more of a Bourbon colony.
That's interesting. And that kind of leads right up to the period where the exhibition starts, and that is, as I hear you describe it, Alfred, the Spanish were interested in part because of the relationship between Spain and France, in part because they had interest in Mexico, of course. You had the Caribbean, and then they started to get worried about the English. In the mid-1700s.
The Seven Years' War.
And that's kind of where the exhibition picks up, if I'm
exactly,
right.
Exactly.
Is that all of a sudden, France, sort of as a precursor, they're worried that England is going to take control
exactly.
of the Louisiana Territory. So
exactly.
they essentially give it to Spain.
Right. And it's very interesting because, you know, for every document in the exhibit, there's probably three or four, and it's not only documents, for every object, mm-hmm. there's probably three or four that we had to leave out. And one of the documents that we have in the research center is a wonderful document. And people don't know about this much. When France saw that they were going to lose Canada, New France, they decided that they should move all of the people and settle them in the Mississippi Valley, because first of all, they knew that the Spanish would welcome them because they were Catholic. They were equipped to farm. It would have been a big boost to the Mississippi Valley. So their plan was to move the people in New France and establish a city like New Quebec, New Montreal. And people don't know about that. Think of how exciting that is. And we have that very document in the research center. But that's just too much to show off. And so we start the exhibit by showing, first of all, the background between New Orleans and the Caribbean that I was speaking about earlier. Mm-hmm. And then we move on to the relation between the Spanish and French monarchs. Of course, the French monarchs were known as the most Christian monarchs, and the Spanish monarchs were known as the most Catholic monarchs, which is sort of interesting because they both were rather hard on the church, which people don't realize at throughout their tenure. But the thing is, they were constantly signing agreements. They signed three major agreements. Basically, they were agreements to help each other. And in 1762, when Louis the 15th saw that the loss of the Mississippi Valley was imminent, he wrote this beautiful letter. And the letter begins, "My dear brother and cousin." He's writing to Louis the 15th. Now, as that letter was sent to Louis the 15th, we have that original letter in the exhibit. And then we have the copy that Charles III, Carlos III, wrote back. And initially, Carlos III wasn't jumping for joy, but he realized he had to populate the Mississippi Valley to defend the Mississippi Valley to prevent British excursions. So therefore, we have right next to the letter of Louis the 15th, the response of Carlos the 3rd.
Yeah, and I think, so I read through, we were talking before we pressed play, as with many exhibits, there is a wonderful hardback book titled The Name of the Exhibition, Spanish New Orleans and the Caribbean, and it walks you through that. One of the things that's amazing to me about the book is that it is written in both English and Spanish side by side, so that you can see, you can read in English, and of course, if you are Spanish speaking, you can read in Spanish, but it kind of emphasizes the way that you guys did the book also emphasizes that relationship and the back and forth and the tension with all of this was done really as a counteroffensive to the English.
Exactly, but not only that. We hope this book will become a teaching tool, because there's more and more bilingual international schools in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. There's a greater emphasis on foreign languages. But also, if you look at the Spanish population of New Orleans, and it's a way for us to say welcome to them. You know, we want everyone to feel welcomed in this exhibit. And the other fact of the matter is the museum world, you know, is changing rapidly. And it's more and more common for museums to have some sort of aid for people visiting in a foreign language. But basically, we just wanted to say welcome to the Spanish-speaking community. And also, I'm partial. I think it's a rather good introduction to New Orleans that Spanish people will be able to use not only for the duration of the exhibit, but in years to come.
Well, and it gets to one of the things that jumped out at me and in the book, and therefore when the exhibit comes out, is that you guys talk about in the book the very heart of the city, right? So we think about the French Quarter as the original New Orleans. In the heart of it is today what we consider Jackson Square, but Jackson Square, the square itself, as well as the cathedral and the two buildings on either side of it, the Presbyterian and the Cabildo, were the Spanish seat of government here.
Exactly, you know, and, you know, that's the Jackson Square is considered to be one of the great metropolitan centers in the United States. And, you know, when the Spaniards came here, they had a lot of experience in governing colonies. And, you know, previously, you know, if you look back at the 16th century, people do not realize the number of books that the Spanish published in Indian languages. It's a phenomenal number that is just beyond belief. And so the Spaniards were used to dealing with subjects in foreign languages. I'm not trying to say they did everything perfect.
Sure.
You know, but in Mexico today, put your seatbelt on. There's 365 Indian languages still spoken. Imagine what it must have been like in the Spanish period. In Guatemala, which is a much smaller country, there's over 20 Indian languages spoken. And they had to learn to speak those languages. Well, very fortunately for Louisiana, it was something as simple as French. Though some Spaniards did do wonderful studies on Indian languages and the Native American population. Very important studies that deserve greater credit. And I only wish that those studies were here, but rather they're like at the American Philosophical Society.
Sure.
They should be here. But I don't think I can get away with moving them. But the thing is, for example, all of the broadsides, if you look at all of the broadsides published during the Spanish period, in general, for any colony, about 10% of the publications survive, which is not much. But if you look at the broadsides, which were the way for the Spaniards to announce to the vast majority of people what the new rules or what was going on and, you know, the new changes, the vast majority are in French. Then there are a few that are bilingual, and then there's even fewer that are just in Spanish. And there's a wonderful letter from the Cabildo, which is the current city council, so you can see the impact that Spain had on us. you know, they were having a hard time writing to Madrid in Spanish. So they wrote a letter apologizing that they were having to use French initially because they didn't have someone on the Cabildo that could speak Spanish fluently enough to write. So you see, the Spanish had what could be called a principle of adaptation. They realized that they had to adapt. Once again, I don't want to paint a picture that everything was perfect. Usually, the farther you got from New Orleans, the seat of government, things became a little bit shakier.
Sure.
You know, but it just goes to show you, you know, that they did realize. And one of the things that we have in the exhibit that is just so beautiful, that shows the relation between France and Spain, is something called the Flower of France, which are, it's a collection of miniatures of all of Carlos III's French cousins, and they're miniatures, but they're framed in the shape of a fleur-de-lis. Mm-hmm. And when you look at who painted these miniatures, you think, by goodness, it's worth coming just to see the Van Loo of Louis XV. And from there we go on to show what a rough life it was coming to New Orleans. It took about 60 days. The boats were not particularly large, you know, and of course we're used to like a Boeing 747 or 57, and after 8 hours we're being tired of cramped in a seat.
Sure.
Well, imagine a 60-day voyage where you're in a space ranging between 16 square feet or 20 square feet. And people kept with them their most prized possessions. And their prized possessions included their pig that they would eat along the journey. So it gives you something, you know. But in the 18th century, they began to have some sort of canvas funnel that gave them a semblance of fresh air. And they had something on all the ships by the time they were coming to Louisiana called a jardine. Now, most people that know a little bit of Spanish and they think jardín, they think it was a garden where they might be growing vegetables or something. That was not the case. It was a portalet strapped to the side of the toilet. Now, imagine that type of life for 60 days. It wasn't easy getting here. The Spanish traveled in fleets for protection. At one point, one fleet went to Cartagena de Indias. The other part of the fleet went to Havana. And then in Havana, they broke up. One part of the fleet went to Veracruz. And the other part of the fleet came to New Orleans. And it was a rough journey going upstream. And it really tested one's powers of endurance.
Well, and you also think about that time period, while you've explained clearly, and the exhibit does a great job of this, in arguing that Spain's influence really goes back to the founding of New Orleans as a colony. If you think about, say, the mid-1760s, at that point, the city is only 50 years old, and it's not very big.
It's not very developed. And, you know, the French military engineers had laid out the city in a perfect grid. Well, there's a difference between French military engineers and colonists. And I remember when they did archaeological digs, excavations in St. Anthony's Garden behind the cathedral. The big thing was when they got to 1788, and you could see the sidewalks and the gutters and everything. That was a big thing.
Mm-hmm.
But when they came back and they went further down and they got to the French period, you know, the French military engineers had laid out a perfect grid.
Right.
That was common for the day. But the citizens, they just built their houses wherever they wanted. And so you might have part of a house protruding into the street.
Sure.
You know, and it drove the military engineers mad. Well, the Spaniards, they had been in the business, like other countries, of developing cities. By this time, you know, there had been a series of disasters, hurricanes, etc. The French did a wonderful job of laying out the projected city where forts should be, but they had a lot going against them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to sell them short. But the Spaniards came. Every time there was a natural disaster, they increased or improved upon the building codes.
Mm-hmm.
And two great examples are the great fires of 1788 and 1794. And one of the items that we have in the exhibit is, today we think of FEMA coming in and establishing a trailer park for people who had lost their house. Well, you know, the Spaniards had been in this business a long time. What do? They take the garden behind the residence for the priest, which is not St. Anthony's Garden, as people often think, but rather it was on the corner of St. Anne and Royal.
Okay.
And they laid out little lots in that garden. They finished its work as a garden, and they divided it into lots. And they're so specific that you can look at that map and see who built their little huts on those little lots. And to me, it's so exciting that we're able to show that plan, but also show some of the artifacts that those people who were displaced from the 1788 fire.
Sure. And one of the legacies, and again, you guys get to it in the book and therefore in the exhibit, is the influence on New Orleans from Spain. It gets to agriculture, it gets to architecture. They changed the building codes after those two fires.
Exactly.
And so you look at Madame John's legacy, one of the oldest houses in the French Quarter, which I believe was occupied by a Spanish military officer.
Yes.
And so he was able to rebuild, at least legend has it, fairly quickly because of his prominence. But there are no wooden buildings in the French Quarter.
I know it.
With the exception of that
very,
somewhat.
Very few.
Because of the code change.
The code changes. And the wonderful thing is, and this is big PR for the collection, when you look at the map, which we have in the exhibit, of the 1794 fire, you will see all that was destroyed. But if you look on Royal Street, you'll see there's a building that survived. And that's the Mario House, the collections property at 533 Royal, which survived the 1794 fire. And I hate to sound boastful, but one time I was at the archive in Simancas and I was talking to the archivist, and she said, where exactly is this, is the historic New Orleans collection located? So I requested that map. They brought it to her office and I pointed to the building. Now, there's nothing uncommon because they made several versions of the map, but they all show the Mario house. But what's funny is, do you know when they made the maps?
No.
On Christmas Day, which just always cracks me up. What, you know, they must have had not too much to do on Christmas Day. And the maps are just gorgeous.
Yes, yes.
You know, but they were all done on Christmas Day. They're just, you know, I got to find out that reason. It's just too good of a story.
Well, and that kind of segues me to, I want to talk about an upcoming event, but before I do, you've alluded to it a couple times, how important the Catholic Church played a role, both in the French and the Spanish periods, but in terms of preserving records. And in the book, you guys mention Père Antoine, and his role, as well as the Catholic Church at large, including the Ursuline nuns, in preserving all these records. The Spanish were really good record keepers.
They were.
But they relied on the Catholic Church as well. And the combination is what gives us such insight into everything from the obituaries that you mentioned to much of what is known about the enslaved and daily life in New Orleans, right?
Exactly. And the Spanish were naturally born records managers. Everything they had to do was laid out. They kept such detailed records that when it was time after the Louisiana Purchase and they moved their records, they made basically an inventory of every bundle of records, which is pretty phenomenal, okay? They were first sent to Pensacola, and then they were sent to Havana, where they lived. Of course, Havana was still a Spanish colony. Those records are so precise that we know exactly which records were lost when a ship sunk on the way from Pensacola to Havana. But at the same time, you had the Catholic Church. And Père Antoine was sort of a controversial person. But one of the things he did, and there's been a fair amount of work done on this, was he saw that the records were getting used all the time. So he wrote and made a duplicate copy of the records. And so many of those records have survived. But that's because it was an institution. Just like the Ursuline Convent has so much that has been preserved intact because they were an institution. But now there's also a few other cases that are worthy of mention. You know, New Orleans functions a little bit different from the rest of the world, in case you haven't noticed. You know, we just march to a different drummer, and there's no making apologies for it. That's the reality. And we have what is known as notarial archives. And that is a treasure trove. In North America, there's only like three of these notarial archives that survive. I know one is Mexico City, one is New Orleans, and I think the other, I forget, it's Canadian, but I don't want to say something and give the wrong answer. But you can go there and you can find so much information on New Orleans. There are plans of buildings that were built during the colonial period. And also at the Louisiana State Museum, they have what is known as the French and Louisiana Colonial Records. Mm-hmm. Those are records, some are notarial records, some are other types of records, but for some reason they were just left behind. Those records can provide such insight into what the community was like. You'll see inventories of books. Mm-hmm. You'll see someone had a dozen paintings or a dozen engravings of ancient Rome framed in gold frames. What is that? A dozen pictures framed in golden frames. You know, but what does that do? That tells you about the community. You can see the fabric that people were buying to make their clothes. And it gives you an idea of what the daily life was like. Mm-hmm. You know, and we were isolated. But as you move toward the end of the exhibit, you will see example of the decorative arts that will make one stop and think. New Orleans was not the little backwater town that people often thought it was. It was not, the Spaniards just didn't have it and just held it for 40 or so years. They really did something.
Yeah, and it really comes across in the book in terms of, again, a relatively, right, we're a 300-year-old city now, 300-plus. For this 40-plus years, what they did in many ways set the tone and took, I would argue, New Orleans from a village and from the beginning of what the French maybe had in mind. And I guess all this should be set against. Obviously, this was Indian land and occupied. And throughout all of this, you have slavery. You sort of get to the notarial records. I'm reading Fatima Sheikh's book right now, Economy Hall. I'm going to talk to her soon. Those notarial records for people looking into the enslaved, for instance,
exactly.
Provide
and
this
it's
resource.
So full of surprises.
Right. Both the enslaved and free men of color, because, of course, when you're talking about the enslaved, they were property. And so there are records of all of that. But the other thing that the Spanish did during that period, we kind of briefly talked about agriculture and architecture. But in that brief period, because of the relationship with what is now Haiti and Saint-Domingue, there was this incredible amount of trade, right? New Orleans was this really vital port.
And the Spaniards had a very different slave code from the French and the English. If a slave had been cohabitating with a Spaniard, they could petition for their freedom. They could buy their freedom. If they were mistreated, they could sue their master. And if a master under the French, I hope I'm being politically correct by saying master, you know, if the slave owner, under the French, if they wanted to free a slave, they had to go and get permission. They didn't have to do that under Spain. Mm-hmm. And then if you look at the Indians, originally, Columbus went back to Spain with 500 Indians that he had enslaved. And Ferdinand and Isabella were infuriated with him. He went back with this great big plan that would have brought great wealth, he thought, to the Spanish world by enslaving the Indians. And Ferdinand and Isabel said no. And they made him return them to where he had taken them from. And, you know, there's three, to me, wonderful documents that we have in a row in the exhibit. The first is a young Indian girl, Native American girl, being sold into slavery by during the French period. The second one is Bloody O'Reilly, mm-hmm. who's the most famous of all right. Spanish governors, who was only here 6 months. He issued a proclamation saying that Native Americans were immediately freed. They were not to be enslaved. And then the next document is an Indian selling property to a Spaniard. Hmm. Now, granted, things were enforced better in New Orleans, and the further you got, it was a different world.
Sure.
But it shows what they were attempting.
Sure. And they still, obviously, there were still thousands of people enslaved. It was not a good situation. I think it is fair to say, as you mentioned, that they granted more rights, and I will use that term very loosely, than the French did.
Yes.
They were at least aware of it. That kind of leads me to one of the things I want to talk about, and we've been on about 50 minutes. But so this exhibit opens up to the public on October 20th, but on October 19th, which is the day that this podcast is going to release, there's a special event happening.
Yes.
And I would love for you to talk a little bit about that event.
Do you have 3 hours? Because, you know, I'm never short on words, and I tend to get excited about
And I think this is a really neat event that's going to kind of bring together many of the themes that we've talked about
exactly.
and that the exhibit is going to show
exactly.
people.
Exactly, because, you know, we talked about how in the early period, French Louisiana did rely on the Spanish world. Well, in 2013, I got an email from a friend introducing me to this wonderful musician conductor who's won probably more awards than a thermometer has degrees. And he had a project to first of all, recreate a mass that the slaves would sing in the French Caribbean. Well, lo and behold, it's based on very popular melodies, you know, that everyone in France would have known. Mm. They were sort of taken direct from little comic operettas, and they set religious texts to them. Mm. And lo and behold, when you begin examining the text, the Ursuline nuns in the 1750s were using some of those same texts to teach Christian virtues, Catholic virtues, to the young girls that they were in charge of. So, you know, it's really very exciting. And so, at first, Pedro began working on that. And then he began working on Minette Ferrand. Minette Ferrand is a very interesting person. The slave mass is something that her grandparents would have sung. Mm. Her parents were free, and as a very young girl, she made her debut as an opera singer in Port-au-Prince, in present-day Haiti. Now, people, you know, they always think of, you know, the steel bands that come up from the mm-hmm. Caribbean and stuff. But it was a very, very sophisticated world in the Caribbean. They had major theaters in the Caribbean at that time. And performances were in the multitudes. And it was not limited to the French world. Cuba, for example, they were doing operas as well. The first oratorio written in the New World was written in Jamaica. Believe that. You know, I mean, this is confusing to the ordinary man on the street. And French opera reigned supreme in the Caribbean. The first opera produced in Havana was a French opera, and that was one of the largest Spanish cities in the New World. And it explains why, in New Orleans being the northernmost outpost of the Caribbean, guess what? The first known opera produced here was a French opera by Gretry, who was also the first opera composer to have an opera produced in Cuba, and was probably the most popular composer in the Caribbean. So the first part of the concert presents the slave mass as it would have been performed under strict Catholic tradition. The second part, the concert, is the recreation of the debut of this young free woman of color who became so important in the opera world.
And she became an international celebrity.
Oh, yes. Yeah. The third part of the opera, of the concert, is the conclusion of the slave mass, except it's done as though it would have been done after the revolution.
Hmm.
So rather than being done in this, it's perfectly beautiful both ways, rather than being done in this perfect European style, it's done with a wide variety of drums, all sorts of percussion instruments, the way that it would have been done after the revolution. Now, you know, there's always something to make things more exciting. Minette Ferrand eventually moved to New Orleans. She became a beloved member of the community. There was a big benefit for her in New Orleans, but she died here. Now, you know how it is at the beginning of the year, and you go to write 2022, but you write 2021. Mm-hmm. Well, what really happened was, you know, the person, it would have been Père Antoine, that was registering her death, wrote 1806. But you can see from the prior records and the records coming forward and the date of this big benefit for her that she really was buried. Her funeral was in the St. Louis Cathedral on the 2nd of January, 1807, and she was buried in St. Louis Cemetery number 1.
Hmm.
So here, you know, you can see not only people will learn not only about the richness of 18th century Caribbean culture, but they will also learn of its relation to New Orleans.
Mm.
And, you know, you don't sing 18th century music like you're singing Leonard Bernstein. And we've made a very strong effort to find the best people that we could to perform the music in the appropriate style. And there's a choral part, and we're using opera creole from New Orleans to do that. And one of the reasons we're doing that is it provides them an opportunity to be showcased.
Mm-hmm.
But hopefully, by using local performers and specialists like from the Amsterdam and Berlin Opera, the two can enrich each other.
Sure.
And, you know, musicologists are terrible. They will kill the enjoyment of music. But ultimately, music is meant to be enjoyed. So it will take place at 7:30 on Wednesday, October 19th, in the St. Louis Cathedral. It's free. The doors will open at 7. Now, you know, every good thing has a problem. You know, what can be better than using as a venue the place where the lady had her funeral? Well, it has a problem. So, you know, life is all about compromises. Well, there's something today known as live radio broadcast. So it will be broadcast live over WWNO, Classical New Orleans FM, and KTLN. Plus, you know, I'm not a technological whiz, but there is this thing now known as streaming. And it will be streamed live via the LPO website. And normally for these programs, we get a good audience of about 30,000 people. So don't let the small number of people that the cathedral holds hold you back. Wherever you are, you can watch this program and hopefully come away with a better understanding of the richness of the interaction between New Orleans and Caribbean.
And I love that is a kickoff. We're going to put links to how you can stream it. We'll put a reminder that if you're here in the New Orleans area and you want to come out and visit it, the cathedral holds about 1,000 people for an event like that. So you certainly could come out. We're going to publicize that because this episode's going to actually release on that day. But we're going to put some information out on our social media so that people are aware of it. What I love when Dave Walker, who helped me set this interview up, and I appreciate it, Dave, when you listen to this, what I love about that is it encompasses kind of what you've spent the last hour talking about, all these influences of the
exactly.
French, the Catholic, exactly. the Spanish, the tension with, during this whole period, there are enslaved people. This idea, you mentioned opera. The first opera house in America, or the first known opera performance, was here in New Orleans.
Right.
You have this woman whose funeral is in the St. Louis Cathedral. The cemetery, St. Louis Number 1, is just a few blocks from where we are. You know, two blocks behind the quarter.
It's all pulls together. It's meaningful.
Yes.
It's just something I personally think that the entire community can be proud of. And I don't know if they'll come away humming a tune, but it's something that my great wish is that the people, whether they attend by in person or streaming or radio broadcast, they come away being prouder of our city's history, and that we learn from that history.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's a nice setup, whether you are local or you get to watch it and listen to it from afar. Again, the next day, the actual exhibit opens. The book is amazing. I've seen many catalogs of exhibitions, and sometimes the catalog's a little dry. This one tells a story. The fact that it's bilingual is really interesting to me. I was saying to Alfred before we came online, I have a 10-year-old daughter who's learning Spanish, and we were able to look at it together, and she was able to pick out certain words, and I was able to say, look, spotlight and un foco, right next to each other. So I think there's that. one of the, I'll say, legacies of Katrina, and you kind of alluded to it, is that we had a large influx of
exactly.
people of Hispanic background come often as laborers to help us rebuild.
Exactly.
But it has created a difference in our culture, a positive difference. And so I think there's a real nod there in having the exhibit and the catalog be bilingual.
Yes.
All of those things, I think, again, you go back to this relatively small period, 40 years, 45 years out of now 300, 302 years, but was so influential and still has an influence on our city today.
Right.
I hope that our discussion has excited people. If you are local, please take the time between October and January and come see the exhibit. Come to the cathedral if you can. If you are coming for a visit, Halloween's a popular time. People will be coming around the holidays. Make a point to come to the Historic New Orleans Collection. We should mention exhibits here, including the performance at the cathedral, are always free. In addition to the special exhibit, the permanent exhibits are terrific. In the tricentennial exhibit, there is this, basically you can walk through 300 years of the French Quarter. You can see this, it's almost like a table that's a tablet, and you can kind of scroll back and forth through time.
Exactly.
Which is an amazing experience. Again, based on those records you talked about, Alfred. And then you have the Notre Dame exhibit coming, which is going to be this really immersive 3D exhibit that kind of goes back and forth from the fire at the Cathedral of Notre Dame and shows you sort of the architecture and the building.
And I'm going to let you in on a secret. Did you know that at the Music School of Notre Dame, they trained many musicians to come to New Orleans? And for example, you find this one person in Thibodeau. He was trained at Notre Dame, but took a job in Thibodeau to lead the brass bands for the Sodality. So, you know, we're just so interconnected with the world that we're very fortunate.
Yeah, and there's so much on exhibit here. You can tell I'm excited. I'm excited about these exhibits, but I want people to come out. I think that the Historic New Orleans Collection gets overlooked. I don't know why that is, but that's part of why we're doing this, to get you excited about this exhibit and get you excited about the things that the New Orleans Collection offers. I should have mentioned it. I did mention at the beginning that Mr. Lemon is the director of the Research Center. And one of the things I found fascinating about the book is that the original General Williams, whom the Research Center is named after, had a passion for preserving the Spanish influence
exactly.
on,
he was
on
doing
New Orleans.
Things that were totally extraordinary for the time. In the 1950s, he was acquiring microfilm from Spain, which was extraordinary, you know, but it shows his recognition of the contribution of Spain. And he was also seriously collecting on Saint-Domingue and Haiti. Mm. So I don't know whether it was his natural intelligence or whether he had simply the intelligence to get good advisors, but was definitely moving in the right direction.
Well, and I just think how neat it is at this moment for us to be physically sitting in the Williams Research Center as this exhibit and the results arguably of his early work are coming to fruition. Again, thank you, Alfred, so much for taking the time and for your passion about this. I cannot wait for people to see it and to come experience it. Again, whether you're coming in town to visit or you're a local, make some time in the next couple of months to check it out. On October 19th, again, whether you're in person or virtually, this promises to be kind of a one-of-a-kind performance.
Exactly.
And it's a one-time performance. I think I'm really excited. It's going to connect all of these parts, right? The Spanish and the French and the Caribbean and New Orleans and all of this, and bring it together and the music. I love that there are local performers who are going to get highlighted as a part of this, kind of continue that showcasing our culture. So thank you so much for sharing.
Oh, thank you for having me. This is something I love doing.
It's been a pleasure. again, I also want to thank Dave Walker, who works in the communications and media department here, for connecting me to you, and a brand new member of the team here, Ryan, for escorting me up here and getting things going. I will put links to everything that we talked about today, about the performance, about the upcoming exhibits, about the HNOC in general, over in the show notes. Again, I'll also, you'll be hearing this the day that the exhibit starts, or the day before the exhibit starts. So we'll put everything that you need to know in order to be able to come check it out. And with that, I'm going to hand it over to my girls to close us out. Thanks, y'all.
New episodes are available every other Wednesday. If you're enjoying the podcast, please share it with someone else who loves New Orleans as much as you do.
Until next time, laissez le bon temps rouler.
Thanks for listening to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. Find us anytime at beyondbourbonst.com.